Can you hear me?
A new song the redeemed sang unto thy name. They proclaimed thy sovereignty and said, the Lord shall reign forever and ever. O Rock of Israel, redeem those who are oppressed and deliver those who are persecuted.
Even God fell a cropper when he tried to organize and control the CIA. The story is told in the book of Numbers. God, as chief of state, orders his defense minister, Moses, to screen 12 undercover agents who will be sent out to spy out the land of Canaan. They are to report on the fortifications of the land, on troop dispositions, the economic conditions of the country, the transportation system. The biblical text reads quite like, I'm sure, orders given to spies today. See the land, see what it is, and the people that dwelleth therein, whether they are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and what the nature of the land is that they dwell in, whether it is good or bad, and what the cities are that they dwell in, whether they are open cities or citadels, and what the land is, whether it is fat or lean, and whether there is wood there or not. 12 men are interviewed and selected and given their security checks, sent out into the cold. They are gone for 40 days from the camp. Then they return and are debriefed, and they report on the conditions that they have seen. Truly, they say, the land whereto thou sentest us is a good land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. Albeit the people that dwell in the land are fierce, and the cities are fortified and very great. And moreover, there are mercenaries there. All agree on the hard facts of what has been seen. The difficulty comes in the evaluation of the facts. 10 of the men turn out to be doves. The land is too powerful for us. We ought not to attempt to conquer it. 2 are hawkish. Let's get going. We should go up again quickly and possess it, for we are able to overcome it. There's a great discussion among the 12, and finally the doves seem to be swaying the National Security Council. And so the hawks leak the matter to the press. A great debate ensues in the camp and great confusion. Moses tries to find the consensus, and he cannot. And finally, God gets disturbed by the whole thing and angry. And his response is to call everyone a nervous Nelly, and he wipes his hands of the whole matter. Spying is as old as history. The first spy was recruited in the first generation of men. Cain was asked, "Where is thy brother Abel?" And he's the first to have refused, we are told, the glamour of being brought into the CIA. Am I my brother's keeper? Spying is as old as man, and the failures of most espionage are written large in history. The great empires and kingdoms of the ancient world all had intricate and well-financed spy systems, which were designed not only to ferret out the secrets of the enemy, but even more so to understand the temper of one's own people, to infiltrate the rebel cells, to see to it that there were no palace revolutions and no popular uprisings. And the record of most intelligence agencies in those days and today is a rather sad one. There are very few successes, and there are very many failures. The Bible tells us that David once wanted to attack the Ammonites. And so he infiltrated agents into the land, and the agents were quickly caught, and they were shaven of their beards and of their heads, which was the great shaming, the greatest shame that could be given to an Oriental, and they were sent back to David. We're told in the Bible that Absalom wanted to find out whether there was support in the among the tribes of Israel for his pretensions to the crown. But he sent spies among the tribes. But these spies quickly found that spying is a good business. They became double agents, and their false reports to Absalom led to his quick downfall. The history of espionage, of intelligence activity, is simply this: that guile leads to guile, that espionage leads to counter-espionage, that the infiltration of agents leads to the double agent, and that, briefly, if a country wants to dupe another nation, it will always find some way to do it. One wonders, for instance, just how taken in the Russians were, the cynical, cold-eyed Russians, by those bright-eyed young American students who suddenly thronged to all kinds of festivals and student meetings behind the Iron Curtain with their cameras and their tape recorders, and apparently with their CIA identification cards in their wallets. Spying is as old as history, and I frankly see no possibility of our renouncing intelligence activity. If we cease to spy between nations, which is doubtful, corporations will always be spying on other corporations to ferret out business secrets. Sports buffs will be spying out on next Saturday's grudge opponent to get their game plans. And Johnny will be spying on Janie's examination paper to get a better grade and to do a little cribbing. Spying is a statement of human fear and of human greed. And as long as we are human, there will be the greedy among us, and all of us are fearful. But the wise nation, though it engages in these activities, sees to it that the intelligence forces of the state are used to serve the best interests of the state, and that they do not threaten the stated policies or the existing institutions of that community. And this is all important, for espionage by its very nature exists beyond the law, in the gray areas, deep in the shadows, and it can, of course, again and again, be exposed, create an incident, and change, in a sense, the whole course of history. I submit to you as an example the shooting down of Mr. Powers's U-2 in May of 1960, that high-flying photo reconnaissance plane, which was of ours, which was shot down over the Soviet Union, and which turned the thaw of Camp David into the nuclear confrontation of the summit conference of Vienna. No one has ever made clear just who ordered that particular overflight, There has always been a suspicion that though the general principle was approved by the president, this particular program was authorized at a far lower echelon, and that there was the possibility that it had been authorized in the hope that a thaw in the Cold War might be prevented. 1947, Harry Truman, as President of the United States, brought the Central Intelligence Agency into being. He did so because America could not forget the attack on Pearl Harbor, and because we were plunging into the dangers of the Cold War. 16 years later, Mr. Truman had this to say about this CIA. There is something about the way the CIA has been functioning that is casting a shadow over our historic positions, and I feel that we need to overcome it. His concern was largely for the shadow which the CIA was casting over the conduct of our foreign policy. There seemed to be reason to believe that the CIA in certain parts of the world was following an independent line. For some time, the State Department, through its ambassador in Cambodia, had been attempting to make friends of Prince Sihanouk. The CIA had other ideas and involved itself in an assassination plot against the prince, an abortive plot, which was foiled, which failed. And the prince never forgot or forgave this plot, and if you would understand why the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese received sanctuary in Cambodia, at least part of the reason lies in this American CIA involvement in this plot almost 15 years ago. At that same time, the United States was interested, or our State Department was interested, in cultivating the friendship of the new Washington of the Indonesian Republic, the hero of their independence, Sukarno. CIA had other ideas, and it supported with airplanes and money a rebellion of Sumatran peoples. An American pilot finally flying an American plane was shot down by Sukarno's troops. And Mr. Sukarno never forgave, nor did he forget. And much of his precipitous turn left, it is believed by some, can be attributed to this CIA involvement. The State Department seemed to be moving towards detente and towards coexistence. The CIA seemed to be moving towards a more hard-nosed, hawkish attitude in the Cold War. The United States in Laos was interested in the neutralization of the country. And Laos had a relatively neutral government. The CIA saw an opportunity to put a right-wing, solidly pro-American general in power, Phouma Nosavan. And in the late 1950s, we involved ourselves in rigging an election for him, stuffing ballots, bribing opponents, buying votes. Such was the success of this CIA coup that the entire neutralist slate was pushed out of office. Such was the success of this CIA coup, taken against the advice of our State Department, that all who had been pushed out of office found reason to listen to Soviet pretensions, and for the first time, the Soviet was given an active and effective political cause in that part of the world. It took 5 years, the most delicate negotiation by our State Department, to prevent Laos, after this fiasco, from becoming what Vietnam was in effect to become. The classic example, of course, of CIA policy determining our foreign policy is the Bay of Pigs fiasco. Here, CIA intelligence, pressed by CIA officials, formed into a CIA invasion plan, was put before a new president, as a relatively easy and effective way of achieving something which the government much desired to achieve, the overthrow of Mr. Castro, and the Bay of Pigs invasion was launched. The result was disaster. The result of what Kennedy was to call that eyeball-to-eyeball nuclear confrontation when the Soviets brought their missiles into Cuba. The world was on the brink of atomic holocaust, all because of a policy which had been formed and woven and created and publicized within the government and encouraged by our intelligence agency. After the defeat at the Bay of Pigs, Mr. Kennedy set about to bring the policies of the CIA and the policies of the State Department and the policies of the Defense Department into a single effective package. And I suspect that since that time, for better or for worse, the various arms of the government have followed a single line. The dangers which the CIA threatens us with now are of another cause. And they come largely, I believe, in this foreign policy field from the fact that the CIA can move as fast as the most modern jet plane, that every involvement in an operation in the field necessarily involves the power and the prestige of the United States, and that the United States is often involved far beyond the limits of its power. The classic example is Vietnam. Mr. Diem is a creation of the French Intelligence Department and of our CIA. He was brought from a monk's cell in Brussels in 1954, brought back to Vietnam, given the money with which to win his way to power by our government through the CIA, supported with technical advisors by the CIA, one of whom at least lived within his own palace, supported by CIA agents, given a carte blanche for the money which he needed in order to buy support. And then inevitably, by the simple act of building up a puppet whom we wanted in that part of the world, we committed ourselves to technical assistance, to military advisory groups, to actual troops, and ultimately to a war which has now lasted well over 3 years, and which has proven already more costly than the Korean War. No one asked the American people whether they wanted to be involved in Vietnam with Diem, or whether we wanted to overthrow Mossadegh in Iran, or whether we wanted to support Nasser in his bid for power in Egypt, or whether we wanted to overthrow Lumumba in the Congo, or Nkrumah in Guinea, or whether we wanted to involve ourselves in right-wing revolutions in British Guiana and Guatemala. But each of these actions was taken through the agency of the CIA upon the decision of the government, not of the people and by the people, but for the people. Little by little, the very existence of the CIA and its mandate to take these undercover actions, to undertake these cloak and dagger missions, has made it possible, indeed necessary, for the government to act by executive order, to act on its own initiative, to deny to the public a knowledge of the commitments being taken. Inevitably, we have committed ourselves beyond the limits of our power, and inevitably, the conduct of our foreign policy, the very principles on which it is based, has been radically and dangerously affected. How did one now affect the conduct of American foreign policy? Well, presumably one can stand up after the fact, after an incident is known, and speak out in opposition. But the experience of Senator Fulbright and others in speaking in opposition to our involvement in Vietnam proves that the thrust of escalation is always more powerful than the counter thrust of political opposition. Presumably, most of this policy is reviewed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But these are a few men, And much of the information which they are given is given to them in secret, behind closed doors. It would be difficult, nay, they would be violating their oaths of secrecy if they took this information to the people to build up a popular support for an opposition point of view. The record of our Congress in these last years does not give credit to the proposition that it is easy for the Congress or that the Congress is willing to make statements which might seem to embarrass the President or the State Department or the Defense Department in the conduct of foreign policy, even when they are markedly in opposition to State Department views. I give you the whole sad history of the congressional attitude towards General Nasser as compared with that of the State Department. What's forward then? I suspect that what has happened is that the United States has effectively moved into a period in which foreign policy is the policy of the government rather than of the people. That we have lost that integral relationship which should exist in a democracy between the will of the people and the work of the government. And I see no way of recapturing this older tradition unless the government is willing from time to time to issue white papers specifying clearly and honestly what it considers to be the aims of current American policy throughout the world, what it conceives to be the strength of American force, the limitation of our effective policy, what it is prepared to do in broad terms and what it is not prepared to do. And then to allow the opposition parties and opposition groups in the United States to debate publicly with it over such papers. This is the British tradition. It is not ours. And I see no desire on the part of the government to make it ours. I'm afraid for the moment we are left in the United States with a dependence upon the goodwill and the wisdom of those in authority. And though I believe in their goodwill and I pray for their wisdom, I submit that in a society which depends upon checks and upon balances, upon law and upon free institutions, this is not the way in which foreign policy ought to be forged, formed, debated, or pursued. Mr. Truman spoke of shadows cast by the CIA over our American life. Recently, the disclosures of CIA activity, CIA financing through the foundations of a score of student groups, relief groups, missionary groups, welfare groups, universities, publishing houses, and the like, has made many of us feel that this shadow is cast large also over our domestic way of life. A democracy depends upon the trust which the people can place in their government, in their courts, in their universities, in their newspapers, in the communication media, and all that feeds us information about our world, and ultimately in those grassroots institutions which we create in order to be effective in a mass democracy, in order to make our will felt in Washington. Each of these has been brought into question by recent CIA activity. The government has been caught in lies, and that's the nub of it. Who of us will forget Mr. Stevenson's honest protestations before the United Nations that we were not involved in the invasion of Cuba, and his shamefaced recantation when Washington informed him that we were, in fact, involved? And do you remember some 2 years ago when the Defense Department insisted long and loudly that we had not attempted to bribe the governor of Singapore because of a CIA fiasco in that little community some 5 years before, when the governor produced a letter from Secretary of State Dean Rusk apologizing for our involvement in that fiasco? Now, there's been much said about the credibility gap between the people and the government. And that gap does not exist mainly because of the activities of the CIA. But I submit that it has come into being parallel with the growth of the power of the CIA, and that the habit of secrecy, which intelligence activities require, is quickly learned and quickly permeates an entire governmental apparatus. Once you begin to lie, it is very hard not to lie. Once you begin to withhold the truth, it is very hard not to argue, as did a recent press secretary of the Defense Department, about the people's right not to know. I'm afraid that the existence of these undercover activity, the fact that they are often, these covers are often blown, I think that's the phrase that they use, and exposed. And the desire of Washington to keep its hands clean from involvement in much of this dirty work has created an atmosphere of secrecy and of security in which the truth has been lost sight of. That is a dangerous item to lose sight of, because if we lose faith in the honesty of our government and its integrity and its willingness to be open with us, the very heart of the democratic process is threatened. The recent activity of the CIA has also brought into question the rights of the individual citizen before the courts. Some time ago, an Estonian refugee accused another of slander, of libel. He had been called an active agent of the Soviet espionage system. He sued the man whom he called the libeler in court for slander. The man who was sued simply brought to the court a letter from the CIA, which said that he had made this accusation upon orders from his superior. Now, I have no doubt that the man who brought the charges was, in fact, what the CIA accused him to be. But I wonder and I worry, when all a man needs do to slander another is to bring to the courts a letter from the CIA saying he acted on orders. How easy it would be for the CIA to get rid of a gadfly, a reporter who had burrowed too deeply. How easy it would be for an unscrupulous government to get rid of a political opponent whose barbs were feared. Democracy exists because of the protection of laws. It's not only the goodwill of men which creates the democratic system. And this legal protection is the very bedrock on which democracy rests. And once that bedrock is corroded and weakened and pulverized, there is great danger for all of us. CIA activity has brought into question the honesty of the reporting and of the research which we read. It's been shown that at least one American publishing house was directly subvented by the CIA to produce texts on foreign policy which the CIA wanted to have produced, texts intended largely for our universities. It has been shown that CIA monies underwrote some of the major foreign policy institutes of graduate study at Pennsylvania, at MIT, and elsewhere. It has been shown that officials of the CIA published articles in some of the more important foreign policy journals without signing their titles or their relationship to this intelligence agency. It has been shown that the CIA underwrote activities of the Newspaper Guild and has used newspaper and television men as its agents in foreign affairs. Now, we still have a free press in the United States, and we still feel that we receive the most of the truth. But there is danger here. When propaganda is not labeled as propaganda, when the government does not label what it produces as that which is its particular position, when it sees to it that material is filtered into our newspapers, which is editorial, which tells part of the truth but not the whole truth, without indicating that this is in fact all of us suffer, For again, the very basis of a democracy is an intelligent electorate. An electorate requires news, and news must be fed to it by the media, and the media must be free of suspicion. The CIA has brought into under suspicion the very voluntary agencies which we have created in order to express our group feelings and our particular desires. I have in mind the National Student Association, a group which represents some 3 million students on American campuses. Over 80% of its budget was in some years underwritten by the CIA. Now, it has been said and claimed by the CIA that this underwriting was nothing more than the subvention of trips overseas by American students who could oppose the Russian propaganda effort at student conferences and student festivals and the like. I submit that the activities of the CIA within this agency went far more deeply. That in point of fact, the CIA was able to control these agencies as it willed. It saw to it that those whom it wanted as agents were elected to be officers of the agency. It saw to it that unwanted resolutions were not passed. It saw to it, in fact, that abroad, National Student Association representatives spoke what the agency wanted them to say rather than what the NSA stood for or what the young people themselves might have wanted to say. As proof, I submit to you this report by one of the officers of the National Student Association. One of the important elements in maintaining control was that the top officers were made witty, that is, they were brought into the CIA. Mr. Wood, a red-bearded young man, explained. He said that each year, 15 well-placed, highly competent students had been admitted to the International Student Relations Seminar, which was operated for 13 summers until it was canceled last summer. All this time, officers and staff of the association who are witty at the CIA are really observing people and developing choices for office holding. The agency has to be concerned about who is chosen. The director of the seminar usually is a CIA agent. That's all a quote. The seminar was pictured as a recruiting ground for the officer material of the student association. And this in turn was a recruiting ground for agents of the intelligence agency. Over the years, Mr. Wood said, a core of former association officers had been built up in Covert Action Division No. 5 of the CIA, with which the students group's secret relationships were maintained. He said it was sort of like an alumni group. Such CIA agents always attended the association's national meetings and played a vital role in decision makings at Madison, Wisconsin in August of 1965. Quote, in that year, Vietnam was debated very bitterly for 9 hours. The agents were very anxious, first of all, that no absolute position be taken and concerned that no permanent cessation of bombing position be taken. The student association voted for negotiation and for cessation of bombing, providing, however, that there was some show of willingness to negotiate from the North Vietnamese, he said, thus satisfying the agency lobbyists. On another occasion, it was proposed that 3 of the 5 delegates to the National Student Conference be elected rather than named by the association officers. All those people who go to the International Student Conference are CIA agents, Mr. Wood said. This proposal was squashed by the full force of the intelligence agency's lobbying group. These claimed that such a plan would have inhibited the gathering of intelligence at international student meetings, and some American delegates would not have had CIA connections. Now, this is hardly the picture of a free American institution. Not only does it use some of its individuals for intelligence gatherings operations, but it sees to it that the very structure of the institution permits it to carry on its work, and it sees to it that the resolutions of that agency conform with what it believes it desires from these resolutions. More than this, when these young people were abroad, they did not necessarily speak the platform positions of the National Student Association or the general attitudes of the American people. They were presumably sent abroad as representatives of a free society to speak of free institutions and free speech and the free world. And here they were puppets, bought voices. speaking of the freedom of institutions in the free world. I have a little file. CIA has its computers with millions and millions of pieces of information. I have a little CIA of my own. It's a manila envelope in one of my drawers in which I put stories from time to time that I read in the newspapers which simply do not make sense in their context. And often I find if I wait long enough, the pieces fall into place. Well, the CIA exposures of the last few months, few weeks, allowed one of these pieces to fall into place. Last summer, in Nairobi, Africa, there was a meeting of the International Student Conference. There were, at that meeting, five representatives of the National Student Association. And normally, such a meeting would not even have come to my attention. What brought it to my attention was the fact that these five students were the most active lobbyists for a position paper which chastised Israel as a belligerent nation, as a warmongering nation, and which called for the elimination of Israel and the return of Palestine to the Arabs. Now, this position had never been taken by the National Student Association. This position is certainly not congruent with that taken by our own government. Yet these five American students purporting to represent the National Student Association were the busiest lobbyists for this resolution in Nairobi. When pressed by the reporters there for an explanation, they said simply that it was necessary to appeal to the Arab world. They wanted to make contacts with it. But that all falls into place. The Central Intelligence Agency, for which these men were acting, wanted to establish contacts with the Arab world. They wanted to find students from whom they could get information, whom they could buy as agents or as double agents or what have you. They were using this conference to put four or five American students into contact with men in the Arab world who might come to believe that these students were their friends. But what's implicit here? A complete reversal of traditional American positions. It was shown that this National Student Association position was quickly radioed back to all of the Arab capitals. They came to the conclusion there that there was a weakening of American support for Israel. There was some relationship between the peaking of raids against Israel by the El Fatah and the very statement of this resolution. Americans had lost interest in the Jew in this little country. They were interested in oil, they were interested in Arab friendship, they were interested in the Suez Canal, they were interested in opposing Russia. Israel would be written off by American interests. These resolutions are not as innocuous as they seem. And the dishonesty of representatives of a 3 million man and woman organization making these positions in the name of that organization is quite incredible. I'm afraid that the New York Times, in a recent editorial, almost understated the problem. The disastrous effects of the systematic penetration of American educational, cultural, and labor organizations by the Central Intelligence Agency daily becomes more apparent. The strength of these organizations, both in the structure of American society and in their relations with their opposite numbers in other nations, always has been their freedom from government domination. The integrity of pro-American positions, honestly taken by groups and individuals in the worldwide battle of ideas, has been undermined. The independence of American private foundations has been brought into question. In short, faith in American institutions has been besmirched in a way that would have eluded the reach of any foreign enemy. It is no excuse to say the CIA's decision to use a limitless range of philanthropic fronts to funnel its funds into youth groups, universities, and other private institutions was designed to meet a very real problem of the Cold War. The need for assuring that the communists would not have an unchallenged field in the youth congresses and cultural conferences they were arranging and subsidizing on a global basis 10 and 15 years ago. That problem should have been met openly by direct public subsidy. It should have been clear long ago to the CIA's overseers in the White House that the end effect of clandestine subsidies to groups representative of the detachment and diversity of a free society must inevitably taint the genuineness of their detachment. This would be true even without the charges that have now developed, that the assignment of CIA operatives to influence the policy statements and choice of officers of the National Student Association, a practice that may have extended to other organizations as well. And I would add a paragraph here. By financing and sponsoring 30-40 American agencies and institutions, the CIA has made their planks that much more effective or that much less effective on a domestic scene. Let me give you an example. Until some 10 years ago, there was an organization by the name of the American Friends for the Middle East. The American Friends of the Middle East was an Arab front, sponsored largely by a few dollars given by the American oil companies. American ambassadors and their families who had lived in Arab countries for a long time. Its major role was to go onto the campuses in the United States to preach against the state of Israel, to preach against Zionism, to speak of Israel as an imperialist nation, to carry out the Arab line. Now, until 10 years ago, the American Friends in the Middle East was limping along on a budget of something less than $200,000 a year. Today, its budget is over $2 million, the bulk of it's given to it by the Central Intelligence Agency. The Central Intelligence Agency was interested in using the contacts which this lobbyist group had in the Arab world. But what is the net effect? The net effect is to build up the American Friends in the Middle East into one of the major propaganda agencies in the United States, which now can have well-oiled, well-tooled units on every major campus, units which not only attack Israel and Zionism, but Jews and Judaism. The result is that a group which would have on its own gone out of existence in a period of time has been given new life, a new power, and the very things for which that organization stands for run counter to the stated policy of our own government, which is a policy of friendship and of support for the state of Israel. And I speak of the organizations in the field in which I know. I am sure that the Asian Student Press Bureau, the Crossroads Africa Group, the International Student Conference for Africa, the International Union of Socialist Youth, the National Youth Center in New Delhi, the North American Secretariat of Pax Romana, the Christian Workers for Central Africa, all of these groups, each represents, within the context of world affairs, some narrow political line, and that by the support of these groups, America has blown up the effectiveness of this lobby, of this propaganda, manifold. No, we cannot take the exposures of the last several weeks as simply a well-intentioned desire by the government to receive as much information and intelligence as it can about the rest of the world, and an operation which did not threaten the integrity, the viability of the basic grassroots organizations of American life. In fact, it did and does. Because the preliminary report of the White House panel empowered by the president to investigate this whole area is essentially a whitewash. It says no more than this. The CIA acted within its authorization and directives. The CIA gave to courageous and fine young Americans an opportunity to serve their nation and the free world in a time of great danger. That's the sum and substance of it. Now, I had believed that the difference between the Marxist world and the free world was in our whole attitude and philosophy of government. The Marxist world believes that the individual exists to serve the state. The free world exists because it believes that the state exists to serve the individual. So the question is not whether the CIA gave some of us, some people, an opportunity to serve the nation. The question is, does the existence of the CIA within its present directives actually serve the best interests of the nation? And I submit it does not. I submit that these directives are too loosely drawn. I submit that these directives allow the CIA to interfere within the context of what happens within the borders of the United States. And that it is a threat to that democracy that we hold dear. What ought to be the directives by which the CIA is governed? First of all, it should be directed to label all that it publishes and sponsors as coming under its contract, as being published by its orders. Americans will respect a white paper published by our government. We'll read it carefully and judge it judiciously. But we want to know who is saying what. Who does he stand for? What position is he arguing? And why? It's been found that the CIA has sponsored Radio Free Europe and other propaganda radios and television stations around the world. It would be a tragedy were it not if this kind of propaganda activity were to grow on the American scene, and it will grow inevitably because all institutions grow unless we see to it that government-sponsored publication is labeled as having been sponsored by the government. That does not denigrate it. It does not weaken its rational force, if indeed its force be rational. It simply indicates it to us. Who said it? Why? And then I think that the CIA must be scrupulously prohibited from sponsoring agencies directly. It is one thing to ask an American citizen to report on his visits abroad and what he has seen and whom he has contacted. And as long as this does not violate some privileged business or professional communication, I do believe that the citizen has a responsibility to make such reports to the government. That is one thing. It is quite another to sponsor agencies, grassroots organizations, to see to it that their leadership are your agents, to see to it that their resolutions agree with your party line, to see to it that their activities abroad conform to the best interests of some other agency. I do believe that it is time that we require of the CIA or of the government generally that believes that our students should go abroad, or our physicians should go abroad, or our scientists should go abroad, or our business people should go abroad, that they go abroad with the open sponsorship of the government. We're not fooling anybody anyway. But at least let's see to it that when we create institutions, grassroots groups, which express this political attitude of ours or that political attitude of ours, this desire to missionarize, this desire to relieve help, that we are creating an agency which we can in fact control, which can do what its citizenry, what its polity wishes it to do. And as long as the CIA uses these foundation fronts to infiltrate these agencies, the agencies will respond more to the needs of an intelligence gathering group than to the desires of the people who created it. And finally, I believe it is time that a very high-level group of government people and representatives of the people sit down and work out a far better system for the long-range and reasonable control of an intelligence agency. It is time that we examine the foreign policy ramifications of its very structure. It is time that we relearned a lesson of history, that an intelligence agency by its very nature becomes a force within government, and that it can become a separate force, apart from the very government that it seeks to serve, very easily. Do you remember Mr. Beria in the Soviet Union? Think of some of the problems which have come up in China over the question of who controls the police, which means the intelligence group. I don't think that this will happen in the near future in the United States, but it is a clear and present danger, and one which ought to be examined and dealt with before the danger comes upon us, rather than after. It is not that I love this nation less, but that I love it more that I say these things. It is that because I prize the freedom on which this nation is founded. It is because I recognize that freedom must be protected even from those who say that they are the champions of that freedom. It is because we are moving into an era of shifting political power, and that in such an era it is necessary to reestablish that intricate system of checks and balances and laws on which a democracy is based. Under the pressures of the Cold War, we moved precipitously to create instruments to fight the Cold War. The Cold War is not over, but there is another war. It is the war to protect our own freedoms. And in order to win in this war without bloodshed, without increased tension, in my humble opinion, we must act now to see to it that these agencies of government are brought into line with the policies of the government and that they are prohibited, even though it may reduce for a time the effectiveness of their operation, that they are prohibited from subverting those precious institutions of the university and of the press, and of the grassroots organizations, the volunteer organizations, which are part of the foundation rock of this nation of ours. Amen.